Welcome to Face Connecticut, an in-depth look at today's issues.
Good morning, everybody, and welcome to Face Connecticut. I'm Morgan Cunningham on WTIC News Talk 1080, Light 100.5 WRCH, and also 96.5 TIC. Our guest this morning is State House Speaker Matt Ritter. And the two of us are going to talk about the outcome and how everything went in the 2024 legislative session. Good morning, Speaker. Welcome to the show. How are you?
Good. I'm doing great. Good morning.
Thanks for coming on. We really appreciate it here. So just overall, what were your thoughts on the outcome of the legislative session that just recently wrapped up?
Yeah, I mean, look, our primary task and goal in any year is the state budget. And we leave, knowing that we have put another $1 billion into our pension fund, that our budget reserve fund will grow to about $4 billion, just record-setting numbers all around and good news for the state. And we know that we were also able to appropriate funds for our higher education system, our nonprofits, our municipalities, particularly the more distressed municipalities. And so, there was some fighting and bickering over whether we should open the budget back up. But at the end of the day, when you look at what we were able to do without doing it, I think people were pretty happy. And I would note we did receive some Republican votes for how we decided to end the fiscal year in terms of budgeting.
You know, it's interesting because, as you mentioned, a lot of money was spread around as best as possible. And at the beginning of this legislative session, as you're well aware, there were many people, many groups that were saying, we need more funding, we need more of this, we need more of that. And so for groups that maybe didn't get what they were hoping for, or perhaps didn't get anything at all, what would you say to them about maybe next year's legislative session?
We'll see what happens next year. It is hard to predict sometimes exactly how much spending cap room you'll have. We have collective bargaining with state employees that has to happen, so it's hard to say where that will land. We'll see how the pension investments do. We'll see how much interest we earn in our budget reserve fund. All these things can make a big difference and how much we can spend. But, there will be room. But again, it's not a limitless amount of money. And, what I always tell my caucus is we have to prioritize. It's very difficult. And so what I would say to groups is two things. I would say one is I'm hopeful we'll be able to do more things next year than perhaps we were able to do this year. But the second thing is, the asks have to kind of also fit into the overall picture. And so, asking for one group to take all the spending cap room, for example, is going to be problematic. And incremental progress can be an important thing at the legislature. Increasing funding slightly year over year within our budget context can be a big victory. And sometimes groups try to hit a grand slam, and sometimes you got to hit singles and doubles and sort of work your way up. But next year, for example, I could see, child care and increasing Medicaid rates as two things, for example, we didn't get to this year that I think our caucus wish we had.
Speaking about those priorities, of course, Governor Lamont outlines what he's hoping for out of each legislative session at the beginning of it, as he did earlier this year. And one bill that lawmakers, were looking at as a priority, of course, was the artificial intelligence bill. And I'm going to run through a number of these in no particular order. We might as well start with AI, Senate Bill 2. It did pass the Senate, but not in the House. And it just kind of died there in those final days of the session, the bill that would have impacted civilian use of AI, including how it's used in electoral campaigns. It would also prohibit revenge porn. What happened? Why didn't it cross the line, Speaker Ritter?
Yeah, so the Senate did pass Senate Bill 2. We did not pass it in the House. And it was basically because the governor was very clear that he would veto it. The governor does not use that word often. I actually respect that a lot. He gives the legislature a lot of flexibility and freedom to sort of work through issues. But at that point, and look, the Senator Maroney, who drafted SB2, is a very good friend and a national leader on these issues. But it was a tough spot for our caucus in the House. And the other thing is we didn't have any Republican support, right? So there was no hope of overriding the veto in any way. We would have been in the 80s or low 90s, perhaps, on that bill. And you need 101, obviously, to override the veto. So we just made the determination, ultimately, that if they couldn't work it out, that we'd revisit it next year. And that's where we are.
Do you think that it will come back up next year, 2025?
I do. But the governor's concerns about being sort of the first state or one of the first states to regulate it probably don't go away. I think the question is, in the interim, what other states or legislatures adopt some sort of regulation? Colorado, I think, did something recently. But let's see what the big states do, a California or a New York or something like that. But I unfortunately think the concerns don't go away if, you know, we'd still be one of the first, you know, two or three states to do it. Ultimately, you want Congress to regulate it, though, right? And that's the tricky part for a state legislature is, as Congress has become more dysfunctional and unable to get together to do a host of things, more of these issues are going down to the state level. But the reality is AI should be regulated federally. All states should have, you know, be looking to Congress to do it. And instead, now everyone's looking at the states. And a hodgepodge of regulations and statutes on AI, whether it be in Connecticut or Texas or Idaho, doesn't seem to make a lot of sense, obviously. But clearly the states are trying to fill a void that Congress has left.
Speaker, did you get involved at any point, maybe in those final days of this year's legislative session, with the governor and also maybe with your colleagues in the Senate about trying to get that bill passed this year? Or is this something that maybe everybody thought was best that this just kind of die in 2024 and think about it again in a year?
Yeah, I'm always going to try to urge people to get together. It's sort of my personality. I don't like big issues to sort of die in the vine. So, yes, I made overtures to the governor's office and to the senators, and, you know, we just couldn't get there.
Spending, that was another big topic, especially at the end of the session, talking about that remaining ARPA money, the American Rescue Plan funds, and some of the groups that received the money, higher education, nonprofits, both were among those trying to push for more funding. And, of course, there was the criticism from the Republican colleagues that the budget should have been reopened to make these investments and to adjust accordingly. But that became pretty contentious. It didn't happen, and it still passed. So could you talk about the money and maybe some of that controversy?
This is an election year. People need to try to find issues to sort of run on. So I can understand where there were some Republicans who felt we should open the budget. But to me, it wasn't a real controversy. Our budget is fine. I mean, it ended the year with a over $1 billion surplus. So, and the revenue projections for fiscal year 2024-25 are just as good and rosy. You know, we do biennium budgets in the legislature. I don't know if everybody understands that we're not a municipality where we do a new budget every year. We actually adopt in the odd year a two-year budget. And so if the budget that you passed, which, by the way, when we passed it last year, was the most bipartisan budget, I think, in a very long time. I mean, the vast majority of people voted for it in the House and Senate. Why would you reopen it? There was just no reason to do it. So I think that was just one of those things that happens in an election year. I think everybody intellectually understood the budget was in a good place, kind of leave it alone. And I think that's why you saw a couple senators and I think five House members on the Republican side vote for the ARPA allocation that we did. So I think leaving the budget the way it was made a lot of sense, and that's why, you know, like I said, I think we did pretty well in the vote count there. With respect to the ARPA allocations, we have to spend the money by the end of the year, all right? So if you don't spend the money or have it contractually obligated to be spent by the end of the year, it goes back to D.C. Nobody wants that outcome. So some people said to me, well, let's open the budget and then do ARPA on top of that. But that would have taken a while to sort of figure all that out. And so we really wanted to focus on getting the ARPA out the door. And the legislature also is out of session now. So if we did not allocate it, the governor would have been the king, the czar, the president, whatever you want to call him, and spent it any way he wanted. And a lot of our caucus members wanted to make sure that we had our imprint on how the ARPA dollars were spent. So the race against time was not only the end of session, but also this race to get ARPA dollars contractually obligated by December 31st. So there was a lot of thought put into how we did the budget this year, but that's why we chose what we did.
Speaker Ritter, my guest this morning on Face Connecticut. I do want to ask you about something the governor said after the legislative session had ended, and he held his news briefing at his office and talked about what he thought came out of the legislative session this year. And he seemed to indicate maybe that he has some concerns for the budget in 2026, specifically saying that ARPA money is not going to be available, obviously, come 2026. Yep. So what are some concerns that you might have, if any, looking ahead 2 years?
Yeah, it's a fair point. In the ARPA allocations, I would say about $250 million is sort of might be arguably ongoing expenses that we use. So about $250 million. Now, put that into context, our biennium budget is well over 40, you know, north of $42 billion. So it's not a huge number, But it all comes down to spending cap growth and how much we have, right? We're constrained by our constitutional spending cap as to what we can spend on an annual basis. So, yes, it's concerning because it's not, if it was just funding those things, it wouldn't be that difficult. What's more challenging is when you have to fund higher ed, municipal aid, nonprofits, Medicaid increases, right? Rates for our providers, early childhood, healthcare costs. All those things add up. And that's where, yeah, there's some concern. But we've been able to do it now for 5 or 6 years pretty consistently, where I think we find a balance between, you know, our fiscal health and also the health of our residents and the groups that I just mentioned and all the things that go into that. And I'm very confident we'll be able to do it again in 2 years. But I've learned not to get too far ahead of myself. To give someone listening to this perspective, we, on April 30th, when we got consensus revenue, saw a jump in over $500 million in tax revenue from what was projected. So it shows you that projections this far out are very difficult, and you really have to wait till you kind of get there to know what you're going to have.
I want to talk a little bit, Speaker, about paid sick days and how they've been expanded now in Connecticut. What does this mean for employees and also employers in Connecticut for the next few years?
Yeah, so the first thing is we phased it in over 3 years. So depending on where you work and how many employees are at your place of work, you know, that will impact when you see this benefit. But I think when I met with a lot of businesses, there was a lot of confusion. This is not an additional requirement if you already provide 5 days off. So what do I mean by that? Most employers, especially, you know, more than 10, 11, 15 employers and all the way up, provide vacation days, right? I know of very few workplaces that can recruit and retain people that don't provide vacation days or some sort of policy for time off. If you do that already, you're already in compliance with the law. And that eliminates a lot of businesses, quite frankly. Most businesses provide some time off or vacation day. So if you have 2 weeks vacation, you've already complied with the law. If you have 1 week vacation, you've already complied with the law. It means nothing to you. It's nothing, no additional burden or benefit you have to provide. Where it got tricky in the legislature was small businesses, right? What do you do with two people or four people or part-time workers? And admittedly, that was what held it up the last couple of years. What we've tried to do is do sort of an accrual method, give people 3 years to prepare for it. And if we have to make tweaks, we will. But we feel pretty confident that within a couple of years, as businesses prepare for it, we'll be in a good place for them to implement this. And again, I don't know of a lot of places of work that don't provide people some time off, which means you already comply with the law.
There was a lot
and
of Republican.
I'd add one more thing. I should have said sorry. We exclude seasonal workers, and the definition of that is working 120 days or less. So that means that, you know, the 17-year-old camp counselor, somebody who only works, for one part of a season for one reason or another, maybe it's a ski slope or something like that, those workers are not entitled to this five-day off because, you know, they're only working less than 120 days. And that carve-out was also a big part of the negotiation.
State Republicans have responded to this whole paid sick day expansion as too costly for businesses in the state, but it seems like you would say that there's a workaround here.
I just don't know of many businesses that don't provide paid time off or vacation days. I just don't. And they already comply with the law. I met with dozens of businesses, and I'd asked them, do you provide time off for your workers? And they said, of course, our workers get 2 weeks vacation. I said, then this law doesn't apply to you. You're already compliant. And they went away and they said, oh, I wish someone would tell us that. We have to sort of market this better. And I think as it rolls out, I think people will understand it's not. There was a lot of confusion, I think, as to what it entailed. Yes.
Speaker, I want to talk about no-fault eviction because that received a bit of attention throughout the session and some pretty heated public commentary and so on at the legislature, but it didn't make it. What happened there?
Yeah, housing has become one of the more contentious issues up there, not only amongst Democrats and Republicans, but I think within my caucus as well. There's a lot of disagreements on it, perhaps depending on your perspective or where you're from. We did do a couple of things. One thing we did in Connecticut that we were one of the few states that did not have this is we're now going to require a 45-day notice for a rent increase. I didn't realize this until doing some homework on it. We were one of the few states that had no notification requirements. Which is odd. So 45 days puts us in line with a lot of other states across the country. And so that was one victory. I think that will better hopefully balance a tenant-landlord relationship. I mean, imagine getting a rent increase a week before your lease is set to expire. You don't have a lot of time to find a new place. Now you have 45 days to perhaps shop around and move if you don't like the rent increase, or at least go back and forth with your landlord. On the no-cause eviction, you know, we already provided for seniors and things like that. Obviously, this would apply to it more broadly. There was a lot of landlords who opposed it. It is a new idea, so new ideas take time. But generally speaking, I think, you know, these issues will keep coming up, and we have to find a way to try to bring the sides together, whether it be through, you know, contracting requirements or something. And so I'm always confident we can find a middle path here. Maybe the legislation this year was not middle path enough for people, but I think there's a real understanding that, you know, if you are a tenant and you're doing, you know, all the right things, and then one day you're just told to leave for no cause or no reason, there should be some disclosure requirements or rules around that. But at the same time, you have to protect people's private property rights who own the property. And, you know, the more we've talked about this in the caucus, we think contract rights or contracting requirements amongst the parties may be helpful. And right now, there's a lot of agreements that are just verbal and not written down. And maybe if we made people have, you know, think about contracts and what the language says, it may go a long way.
Talking about housing, Speaker, I also want to bring up the protections for nursing homes. For one, nursing home residents can't be placed in rooms with more than two beds as of July 1st, 2027. Were there any other changes that came out of this year's session for our nursing home residents in Connecticut?
There was. I mean, House Bill 5001, which for our purposes means we marked it one of the key priorities. Thus, it is ends in the number one, 5001. Our bill started 5,000 in the House. It was a really good piece of legislation. And it also had language about creating a, you know, more internet, you know, internet friendly searches for nursing homes and their grading, but also a registry for the workers so that you can look up now and find out and rate and review, you know, nurses that are, you know, coming into your home. What we're trying to do is get more people to age in place as opposed to go to nursing homes, which are costly and, you know, that business model is having a tough time right now because we think we can get people to age in place and bring people to their home. But we wanted to make sure that's safe and that people have an understanding of who's coming into their house and the services they're going to provide. So we made a lot of changes that I would consider consumer friendly. And I think it was a good year on that front. And a lot of credit goes to, you know, Jane Garibay and in the House, who's the chair of aging. She did a great job. Senator Hockadale in the Senate. Mitch Belinsky is a Republican who worked very hard on that bill. I was very proud of that. Yeah.
I wanted to bring up HB 5004, Climate Change Advocates, which was also dubbed the Green Monster in the Senate by Republican leader Stephen Harding. And this is one that didn't get across the overall finish line. What is exactly in this bill? What's it about? And do you expect it to return in a year?
Yeah, you know, it's funny I got dubbed the Green Monster. I'm a Red Sox fan, so it wasn't all that offensive to me. But there's no question the original iteration of the bill, you know, was never going to get any Republican buy-in. But the bill as amended and as revised was actually supported by the CBIA, the Connecticut Business and Industry Association. It had a lot of businesses that supported it because a lot of it was just tax incentives and you know, optional things for businesses. You know, we tried, for example, to get a lot of money into heat pumps. We tried to, you know, create working groups on biofuels, things that Republicans had wanted. So I thought the bill went a long way towards meeting some of the concerns. I do believe it comes back next year. The risk you run with a large bill, right, like we did, House Bill 5004, is you sometimes lose all the provisions if you lose the bill, and that's what happened this year. And so maybe next year, those concepts come back maybe as individual bills since we'll have more time. But I'm really proud of the work that Rep. Palm did and Representative Gresko and Senator Lopes. And I think if people read the bill as opposed to being scared off by the original Green Monster, you know, nickname it received, I think a lot of people would have voted for it.
Speaker Ritter, my guest on Face Connecticut this morning. Mr. Speaker, I love to save the best for last sometimes. Going back to that conversation that Governor Lamont held with the press the day after the legislative session had ended, He remarked that he thinks it would take younger people, maybe he's suggesting in the legislature, maybe in Connecticut overall among residents, to move the needle on any kind of electric vehicle mandate and goal on that. So what is the thinking after, you know, that didn't really get anywhere in the last year nearly? What's your thinking on an EV mandate, and what does that mean for maybe next year's session?
Yeah, I have to say that we lose the argument when we say EV mandate, right? What I like to remind people is it's a hybrid car requirement. And there's a big difference. People are who are listening might go, listen to this guy. What's the difference in an EV and a hybrid? What was the big difference? An EV is all electric, okay? A hybrid car can run on gas or electric. I can tell you I had an experience. We went out to Arizona for spring break for our kids, Hartford Public Schools week in April that we were off, and they ran out of gas cars. So we had an electric car. It's the first time I've driven an all-electric car. And there was a problem. We couldn't drive a long distance because we didn't know where we could plug it in Arizona. We weren't from there. And so we really had to limit ourselves, and then we traded the car in to get a gas car so that we could drive, you know, a couple hundred miles out to the Grand Canyon. That's a real concern for people. We understand that. The mandate is hybrid by 2035, and now that's going to get pushed back, it looks like. But the hybrid car allows you to run on both, which I think should provide comfort. I actually disagree with the governor, though, that it's young people or whatever. It's the federal government, right? At the end of the day, the problem right now in our country and in Connecticut is it's more expensive to drive an EV car or a hybrid car, less so. The cost is coming down. But there's also no one really knows where to go to charge their cars. At the Capitol complex, we have two electric chargers, two in the Capitol spot, and I think four in the LOB. At my place of work in downtown Hartford, I think there's five or six chargers, but what do you do if they're all gone? This federal government has to treat this the same way they treated other national initiatives. They have to build this out. They have to help us build out our grids to do this. There's electricity costs to consider. And so when Connecticut's trying to tackle it in isolation with neighboring states, you're going to have affordability and cost concerns. That's why the Biden administration was right when they put this as part of the 2021 Inflation Reduction Act. We need the federal government to put people to work, to put charging stations in, build these cars, and make it a national movement, not a state-by-state movement. And that's why I think what's missing right now in this country.
In my final moment with you, Speaker Matt Ritter on Face Connecticut, do you think that aid and dying might come up again in 2025, and is this the time when it might get across the finish line?
Yeah, I have some constituents for whom this is a very important issue. Let me say what I've said publicly for years. I support the bill. I support the legislation. In many cases, I think it's gotten watered down even more than where I think it should be. But it's not a speaker kind of thing where the speaker can bully a bill through. This is a very individual, personal consciousness decision. And I think it comes up next year, and I think it all depends on the makeup of the legislature. I really do. And it doesn't matter if you're an R or a D. I have Democrats for, Democrats against, R's for, Republicans against. It's just going to come down to, does it one day get to the vote count? But personally, I support it. But this is an individual decision that no one's going to force anybody to do anything on this one.
This is the final question I've asked you in 2022, 2023, now 2024. The pizza bill, when's that going to come back up?
I'm sure it will. I mean, remember, in the odd years, anybody can introduce legislation. You're severely restricted as an individual legislator in the even years. So my guess is in the odd years, next year, over 5,000 bills introduced. And I'm sure aid and dine and the pizza bill, probably on the different end of spectrums of importance, will both be brought back up, yes.
For sure. Well, we'll be following. Hey, thanks for doing this with me. And next year, we'll have another chat, okay?
I look forward to it. Thanks.
Face Connecticut is a production of the News and Public Affairs Department of WTIC Radio.